Americans own almost half of all the civilian-held firearms in the world. Our ratio of guns to people is more than twice that of any country, and gun sales set records in recent years. It wasn't always that way. In the years after World War II, cheap surplus weapons flooded the U.S. market and started to be marketed and sold like other mass consumer goods. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of that boom in guns and how our cultural attitudes around them changed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the history of guns and gun culture in the Cold War era and since then, in your lifetime, have you seen a change in the way we talk about guns and the Second Amendment? And how about gun availability, accessibility, and prices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew McKevitt is the John D. Winters Endowed Professor of History at Louisiana Tech University. He's the author of Consuming Japan, Popular Culture and the Globalizing of 1980s America. His new book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. Drew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
You write in Gun Country that a lot of people, when they're talking about guns and history in America, they go back to the founders and the crafting of the Second Amendment and the 1800s. You see much more recent key turning points, starting with the end of World War II. Can you tell a little bit about that history of, you know, Europe in particular, clogged with surplus weapons and how they find their way to the United States?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the United States has always been a gun country of some sort. But what I argue in the book is that we really become the gun country after the Second World War. And what makes that happen is a number of changes to gun capitalism, to the way guns are marketed, to the way guns are consumed. And the story I focus on is in the aftermath of the Second World War, the incredible availability of cheap firearms from Europe and from Asia. These guns were war surplus weapons. Many of them were rifles used on battlefields in Europe and Asia during the war. And what happens in the beginning of the late 1940s and the early 1950s is we get a whole cohort of what I call gun capitalists who are really entrepreneurs looking to make connections between surging American demand for consumer goods, not just firearms, but all kinds of consumer goods in the post-war United States, which is flourishing as a result of post-war prosperity, and the availability of these cheap firearms. So I write about a number of figures, like the most important of which is a man named Sam Cummings, who creates a company called InterArms, who, beginning in the 1950s, imports hundreds of thousands of war surplus rifles into the United States each year. And these are really cheap guns that drive down the price of guns and increase the availability. And I think we can chart a lot of our gun culture and gun consumerism to that moment.
And you write that guns, I don't think these days we think of them as a consumer product, even though I guess they clearly are. This really was a transformative moment where, you know, someone might have a gun. They might be able to afford one. Now there's cheap guns, starter guns, and they became a consumer item like a washing machine, except you only want one washing machine. How did this change the way we thought?
Yeah, they're consumer goods, right? I mean, they're the Beanie Babies for men of the 1950s or something like that. It becomes a thing to collect, and it's cheapness that enables that. A brand new, well-made, quality hunting rifle in 1955 might have cost you $120, $150 in 1950s dollars, which is something on the scale of, you know, $1,500 today. And that's really expensive for today and for people at the time. And so those were not really sort of entry-level weapons. What gun capitalists like Sam Cummings do is they make incredibly cheap firearms available to more people. So that the equivalent of that $150 rifle is the $10 Carcano rifle that Cummings sells. And this is a rifle made in Italy during the war and imported by the hundreds of thousands in the 1950s and into the 1960s. And this is the very weapon that in 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald will use to shoot John F. Kennedy. And so these cheap guns become collector's items. They prompt a growing kind of consumer market among especially men in the United States, and they're marketed to men as things to collect. That's one of the hallmarks of advertising from this era, is to just display the bounty of guns available and to advertise them as sort of the reward for American sacrifice during the war. You went out and you won the war, and one of your rewards is you get the guns, because this is the only consumer market really in the world where so many guns could be sold.
Another turning point comes in the 1960s, the rise of the civil rights movement, and then riots, especially in 1967 in places like Detroit and Newark, New Jersey. You talk about breathless media reports talking about organized bands of snipers that didn't exist, to be clear. But people start to think about their guns in a different way through this period of unrest. What starts to change?
Yeah, so this is, we have this consumer market there of plenty in the 1950s and the 1960s, and Americans become accustomed to that seemingly limitless access to the world's weapons of war. But beginning really in 1963 with Kennedy's assassination, there is a legislative movement to do something about it. In the U.S. Congress, it's focused on the in the Senate on a figure named Thomas Dodd, who's a senator from Connecticut, who runs the Senate's Juvenile Delinquency Subcommittee, and he's doing investigations throughout the 1960s. What's also happening, of course, in parallel is the splintering of the Black Freedom Movement and increasing tensions in cities and Black uprisings against police brutality, against lack of economic opportunity. And so when you combine this consumer market that has seemed limitless for more than a decade with increasing white anxieties about Black uprisings, and throw into the mix the possibility of gun restrictions coming from US Congress, you get a surge in gun buying. 1967 and 68 is really in some ways it's an echo of 2020 and 2021. With the surge in gun buying we saw as a consequence of the pandemic, of anxieties about another Black freedom movement, this time the Black Lives Matter uprisings of 2020, of a contentious presidential election you have in 1968 and in 2020 as well. And so you see what is essentially panic buying of guns. In 1967 and 68 is an incredible spike in gun buying. And because of all those imports that had been flooding in since the mid-1950s, there's plenty for people to go out and buy.
What does this end up meaning for, you know, if we compared 1938, say pre-World War II, and then coming out of the 60s and 70s, how did we look at our guns differently?
Well, they are seen as items of personal self-defense and a mass level in ways that they weren't so much in the 1930s. There is a wave of gun regulations in the 1930s coming out of the New Deal, mostly targeted at what's seen as the sort of gangland violence of the era. So we get 1934, the National Firearms Act, 1938, the Federal Firearms Act. And guns are, especially things like handguns, are seen at a popular level as kind of tools of criminals. People are seen as sort of suspicious if they need to carry a handgun. But by the 1960s and 1970s, handguns especially are marketed as tools of self-defense. And with the gun control movement of the 1960s, especially the legislative movement coming out of Congress, moving through the Senate and eventually producing the Gun Control Act of 1968, what that also creates is a grassroots gun rights movement, a movement of people organizing at the local level, not just at the NRA, because the NRA is kind of a little slow to get to this. But we get this grassroots gun rights movement that is organizing around this idea that firearms are for self-defense, and especially things like handguns, because it is, as much as we focus on kind of the big name rifles and so-called assault weapons and so forth, it's always been handguns that have caused more violence in the United States. And so that idea that the individual has a right to own something like a handgun for personal self-defense, independent of service in a militia or defense of the country, that really emerges as a mass popular idea at this moment out of this cauldron of stuff happening in the 1960s.
We're talking to Drew McKevitt, professor of history at Louisiana Tech University. His new book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Drew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I want to put a shout out for the women as part of this culture. I'm a baby boomer, World War II, Madison West graduate, and in the 1950s and 60s, for us it was a lot of the TV culture. I mean, the bloodless cowboy programs and Gunsmoke, and I was insane about Davy Crockett. I have one Kentucky line, so I think I identified with the frontier. Also, there were no organized sports for girls in our high school in the 1960s, except one, which I think was the Victory Club holdover from World War II. And so we all joined Girls Rifle Club, and I became a sharpshooter.
Interesting, Kay. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Drew. It was a cultural, I don't know, there's a cultural way of thinking about guns, recreational, pop culture. What do you think?
Yeah, no doubt in the 1950s. I think, I forget what the number was, but at some point in the late 1950s, 8 of the top 10 TV shows were Westerns of that sort, right? And so, in fact, one of the things that Thomas Dodd's committee is going to focus on in the early 1960s is they're going to hold hearings on the role of guns in popular entertainment. And I think rightfully so, lots of witnesses come before the committee and they say, this is sort of bunk, this idea that Westerns and so forth make people go out and commit crimes. But certainly it contributed to the popularity of gun ownership, not in a criminal sense, but in more in a sort of mass popular consumer sense. And so it makes perfect sense that we have rifle clubs in the 1960s, and especially rifle clubs for girls too, especially in rural areas outside of cities or in growing suburbs.
Thanks for the call, Kay. Talking to Drew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country. Back to your calls. Keith is with us in Kewaunee. Keith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Whenever we try to get any legislation work going on gun control of some type, it seems like you hear a lot of things about the Second Amendment rights, but it doesn't seem like you ever hear anything about the first three words of the Second Amendment, which are a well-regulated militia. And I guess wondering what the author's take is on Second Amendment and where a well-regulated militia fits into guns.
Keith, thanks for the call. Drew?
Yeah, I think of myself as a Second Amendment absolutist in the sense that I want to adhere to all 27 words of the Second Amendment. And those first three are just as important as the last 13, a well-regulated militia. When historians write about the Second Amendment, they write about the importance of the militia to Madison's formulation of the Second Amendment and to the eventual passage of the Second Amendment in 1791. And so there's no question among historians, there's a very clear consensus among historians that the Second Amendment was about the relationship between the state, that being individual states and a federal government, and how an armed populace factored into that relationship. The amendment had nothing to do with individual gun ownership, which was something that at the time nobody would have really questioned anyway, because there was a general assumption that an individual had a right to own a firearm. There were state constitutions that protected those things, and there was even English common law that had recognized it in a number of ways. But what's happened in the last several decades is that we've had a very aggressive, concerted intellectual and legal effort to define the Second Amendment as a statement of an individual right, and to use those first three words to sort of push those first three words out and pretend as if they had nothing to do with the individual's right to own firearms. And that's not something that historians would agree with.
Keith, thanks a lot for the call. Drew, you point out repeatedly in your book, United States stands out in the world, most of the world, when it comes to gun laws, very few of them, very loosely regulated. And in terms of gun violence, what do you hope, by looking at this history that you tell in gun country, what do you hope we can take from that and learn lessons from to reduce gun violence here in the United States in the future?
Yeah, you know, it was, I try not to be cynical about this history, because there's a moment in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy's killed and Martin Luther King had been killed a couple months earlier, and Lyndon Johnson appoints a commission. Lyndon Johnson loved appointing commissions. He appoints another one. It comes to be known as the Eisenhower Commission. The Eisenhower Commission is going to look into violence across American history and in American society. And they appoint a firearms task force that says that is the first federal initiative to look into American gun ownership, American gun culture, American gun violence. And they come to a number of really startling conclusions. And one of the conclusions they came to at that moment, 55 years ago, was we have too many guns. And they were talking about a country of 90 million guns at that point, and maybe 180 million people or so. They said, we have too many guns, and if we don't do something about it right now with the 90 million guns we have, it's going to be too late 25 years from now, because we'll have 200 million. And then in another 25 years, we'll have 400 million. If we don't do something right now, we are going to miss this opportunity. And we missed that opportunity. And so today, you know, it's hard to look at this history and to think that we are ever going to do anything to reduce the civilian stockpile in the United States. And so I take hope in the, you know, the gun safety movement that emphasizes things like red flag laws and enhanced background checks, because I don't think ultimately we're going to do anything to reduce that stockpile. Instead, we've just got to figure out ways to keep ourselves safe from that stockpile.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Andrew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America.